Unfortunately, Professor Debbie Sharp would very much like to have been here, has sent her very sincere apologies, but she had a close friend die, and the funeral was this afternoon, and she just couldn't quite make it. And I think in the circumstances, we had to accept her sincere apologies, and she would like to make it up, she would like to come again, but unfortunately, I don't think our programme can accommodate it this year. Perhaps another year, she might come and share her information with us. However, in no way should this detract from our current speaker for this evening, who has stepped on at the last minute, and I'm extremely grateful to her. And she is going to talk on the same area of a cancer diagnosis, and she's going to tell us about it in the home scene. And Dr. Anna Gavin, I think, needs no introduction to the audience. She is the current director of the Cancer Registry in Northern Ireland, and she is the founder director of the Cancer Registry in Northern Ireland. And she tells me this evening it's been there for 16 years, and I find that hard to believe. But I know that she has a wealth of interesting information to tell us, and I think it was great to hand over to her.
Thank you. Thank you very much. And it's lovely to see so many people in the audience that I know, so I'm nearly more afraid because of an audience that I know. When Margaret asked me to do something in her usual nice way, it's very hard to refuse. I've been a member of the Ulster Medical Society for a long, long time, and one of the things that I've often thought was, wouldn't it be nice to be an invited speaker? But I think that sometimes you should watch what you wish for. I'm going to follow on in the theme because it's a very interesting theme, and it's about the promise of earlier diagnosis in Northern Ireland. And any of you who are following things, the CRUK have a programme now which is called NEDI, and it's the National Awareness and Early Diagnosis Initiative. And they have actually made early diagnosis a priority and have identified funds that we all scrabble for and try to get. So we have been in the registry thinking about this as well. And so what I want to do is I want to lead you through this evening and look at international survival differences, then patient delays that we know about in Northern Ireland. I want to mention a wee bit about screening, because I don't think you could talk about early diagnosis without mentioning screening. To talk about our system targets within Northern Ireland for waiting times, and how that's operating and what we hope to achieve from that. And then mention at the very end a very exciting project that Northern Ireland is involved with, which is the International Cancer Benchmarking Project. So, because, as Margaret says, we now have a registry, a very good cancer registry, even though I say it myself, we're able now to compare ourselves internationally. And we have sent data to Europe in a common way with all the other countries, and we're able to see where our survival lies in terms of all of Europe. So I'm not sure if there's a pointer here, but it doesn't matter, I'll just use this. So here you can see where Northern Ireland is, and what I'll do is I'll show you a few of these. This is colorectal cancer, and you can see we're bumping along the middle far, you know. This is very good, and that is not so good. And the European average, say, for males is 53, and we're below that, 51. For females, the European average is 55, and we're below it at 52. Now, we're around the very same as the rest of the UK, but compared to other countries in Europe, the UK is not actually doing that well.
Sorry, can I ask a question?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Do you mind if I ask
a question? Oh, you're very welcome to ask a question.
As we're such a small group.
Yes.
Well, what do you actually mean by a 5-year age-adjusted relative survival?
Right. Well, first of all, if we look at relative, okay, that is takes account of other deaths, so heart disease and things like that are taken into the equation. So relative means these are deaths due to that particular cancer, okay? Because perhaps Poland has a higher rate of death from heart disease than we have, or vice versa. So you have to adjust for that. The other thing is the age adjusted means that it takes account of the fact that we have a younger population, say, than England. And if you just did it without age adjusting, then you would have you'd have more deaths in England, but it wouldn't be a true reflection of what's happening. It would be related to the age of the population. So age adjustment takes account of age. So age is not a reason for these differences, nor is the rate of disease the background rate of disease, such as heart disease or road traffic accidents or anything like that. Okay? And 5 year means, you could look at it as 1 year or 2 year or 3 year or 4 year or 5 year. So 5 year is, these are how many people are alive after 5 years, taking account of the background mortality. So
a percentage of the original number.
It's not quite. If we were to look at just observed survival, so if we had 100 people in the room and we came back in 5 years and saw how many of those were still alive, that would be observed survival. But if, for example, out of that 100, 10 died of heart disease and maybe another 10 died of something else, you would be looking at the survivors out of 80 rather than 100. So relative survival is actually higher than observed survival, because we take account of the background death. That's a very complicated concept. So early in this and so late in the day.
Is there still a percentage at the bottom?
It is still expressed as 100.
Out of 100.
Well, yes, it's expressed out of 100. Yes, if everybody was alive, then it would be 100%. If nobody had died from colorectal cancer, then it would be 100%. So if we were to look at this for testicular cancer, we would see it much higher up the scale, because survival is very good for that. And you can watch the scale as it varies for the different diseases. So I'll be showing you a few of these. Okay? Males and females.
Thank you.
Alright.
Sorry, I'm just...
Yes?
You're taking...
Yes?
When does the 5 year kick off? Is it from date of treatment? Diagnosis?
It's from date of diagnosis. Date of diagnosis, yes. And these are for different periods. I can't remember the exact period, but this would be from... You know, this is... Obviously, this is not recent data, because you have to wait 5 years and then you have to analyse it. So these patients could have been diagnosed 10 years ago. Okay. All right. Good. So this is it for lung cancer. And here, remember the colon was way up. We have adjusted the scale. It's only 15% here. And the European average for males is 11.7. And if you remember, for colon... It was 53, so that relates to the survival of them. So if we look at lung, again, we're sort of sitting around here, very poor 5 year survival. It's slightly better for women, but there are countries that have much better survival for lung cancer. In a way, if we're looking at early diagnosis, we almost should be looking at 6 month survival and 1 year survival, because that's the ones that show where gains can be got in early diagnosis. So,
sorry, could I just ask, does the type of lung cancer come into it?
Well, these are all lung cancers, so you're right, the survival for different subtypes would be different, but this is just all of them. But you could, if you wanted, we could look at different subtypes. Obviously, the numbers would be smaller, say for small cell or something like that, and you might have bigger error ranges. These lines here are the accuracy with which we predict that figure. You can see here Malta has a very big line because the population is quite small, whereas, say, Italy has a much smaller line. Iceland, with a small population again, has a big error line. So that's how you would read those. But you could do it for the subtypes of lung cancer, because it does vary, the survival does vary by subtype.
The female small cells is very, very badly.
Mm-hmm, yeah, that's right. So if we then look at breast cancer, and here we see Northern Ireland, 77.4, and we're just about touching, this is the European line, and you can see our little error bar is almost there. So we're just about the European average, but there are countries which are much better than us in terms of survival for breast cancer. This is ovarian cancer, and you can see that we're sort of in the middle again. So for all of these, because we're able to compare with Europe, we're able to get a feel for where we're at. But in terms of improving survival, we now have a feel that there are places which have better survival. And if I was to put America on this graph, Europe is behind America, so there are huge gains to be got in terms of survival from the various cancers if we compare ourselves internationally. This is melanoma, and I show this because we're not bad, we're actually the best. for men, and we are on to the best for women. And we have had initiatives in that area and very good treatment and things like that. And while we have an increasing number of cases of melanoma and an increasing number of deaths, we our survival for the patients is actually better than the rest of Europe. So this is stomach cancer, again the same sort of diagram, and here we see it's a bit like lung. The numbers here, the percentage who are alive after 5 years is much lower, and we're still sitting all the time around the middle.
And do you mind if I just interrupt and ask, is there anything interesting that you would comment on in terms of differing incidence? You know, there we're looking at survival, but obviously if the incidence is very different because lifestyle, you know, Japan used to have a high rate of stomach, for example, does that have any bearing on things?
There are differences, which sometimes relate to lifestyle. There are big differences in lung cancer incidence, which relate to smoking, and particularly, you know, differences between men and women. And I think some of this background, even though we have taken account of the background mortality, say for heart disease and things like that, if you have a high proportion of your population who smoke, then they're not going to do as well if you treat them, because they will have chronic obstructive airways disease, they may have heart disease that might not appear in the death certificate, they may have say heart disease, which means they can't then have specific treatment or whatever. So, yes, there are lifestyle things, and they're not taken account of in this, but there are descriptive studies which actually go into depth in these Eurocare things, and they would look in depth at some of those things, they're high-resolution studies.
A simple thing, I hope, anyway. The trends, how are the trends doing? I'm perhaps you're going to address that.
Well, I'll show you some of the trends actually later on, because that's a very good question. So, I want to just now, so that's how we compare with Europe. So that's been very interesting and exciting. And what I want to do now is come back now to patient delays. And if we think about it, and you're all aware of friends of yourselves or patients that you know where the delay has been. So the first thing is the patient actually becomes aware that there's something wrong. Now, if the patient isn't aware about cancer or has not the information or the know-how, then that's going to be a very difficult step for them to make. Then they have to somehow decide that they're going to see about it. So there's a bit about, you know, thinking, oh, it'll go away, or what'll I do now? And it might be difficult for them to get their first appointment with the GP. You know, maybe the GP says, oh, we'll see you, that we'll give you an appointment for 2 weeks from now. And they may think, oh, they mustn't think it's too serious. That's great, you know, and sit there for their 2 weeks or whatever. And different countries have different ways of accessing GPs. Some places you have to pay for it, like in the south you have to pay for it. And so that's a barrier, so there are various barriers. So then anyway, the GP may or may not pick up on the symptom, may have access to screening, to x-rays, may not have access to x-rays, may find that they have to join a queue then for a test. Then the patient arrives at the specialist for further diagnostics, and then there's a delay from referral to confirmation of diagnosis. And then there are, once the cancer is confirmed, then the treatment begins, and there could be delays in that as well. So there are lots of places where, you know, a week here and a week there adds up to quite a lot of delay for the patient. So I want to just keep that in mind while we explore some of these things. But first, before that, I want to just mention screening, because it wouldn't be right to do something about early diagnosis without talking about screening. And we have three screening programs for cancer that are recognised here. The breast has been operational for quite a while, the cervix for slightly longer, and colorectal cancer screening has just recently been introduced. And why does it make such good sense? Well, first of all, there is a survival improvement depending on the stage of colon cancer the patient has. So the late Jukes D, this is time since diagnosis. So this is almost another way of looking at your 5 years. This is again relative survival. So the patients who have Jukes A are almost the same as if they never had cancer. So if you can get it at that stage. Jukes B do a little bit less. Well, Jukes C, then there's this mixed bag of unstaged here, which are in the middle, and Jukes D. After 5 years, there's not too many in the line. There's about 12% or some of them in the line. Okay. So that's why you try and have a screening program to have earlier diagnosis of these cancers.
If we then look at trends,
so you were looking at did we have trends here, and we'll come back to survival trends in a minute. This is actually the number of cases of breast cancer and the death. So over time, and this is age standardized, so the rate of death from breast cancer has actually fallen, not too much, but it has fallen. And the number of cases used to be just over 300 a year, and now it's under 300, despite the fact the population has aged, and you would have expected the aging alone to push it up. The number of cases of breast cancer diagnosed has increased since the introduction of the screening program, and that's one of the issues to do with screening. This is age standardised, so the aging of the population is not a reason for this. And part of the investigations of breast screening shows that it does pick up earlier lesions, but it also picks up some lesions that might never have progressed to full breast cancer. And so with any screening program, there's a wee bit of a trade-off with that. And before you introduce any screening program, there are quite a number of criteria that have to be addressed, which includes the harm-benefit ratio for patients, which includes all the things about cost-effectiveness, and whether there will be an improvement in the outcome for patients. So if we look at cervical cancer, and this is from 71 to 2001, and these are deaths. So when we screen for cervical cancer, we aim to pick up a precancerous lesion, so the cancer is never actually developed, and so that the people don't die from it. So triangles here are the south of Ireland. Right? So the south of Ireland started with a lower level of deaths from cervical cancer than Northern Ireland, and this may be a treatment effect here. But their level has actually increased over time. They don't have a screening program, and the whole lifestyle change, there's been quite a lot of lifestyle changes in our society and also in the south of Ireland related to sexual health. This here is Northern Ireland here, so we had a few more deaths, but our level has gone down, reflecting treatment and reflecting the screening that was organised, first of all on an opportunistic basis, and since 89 on a population basis. In England, where they reorganised their screening programme here, you can see the deaths were going along here, this is England and Scotland, and then the introduction of the screening programme brought them right down. And there are figures very like this from Scandinavia, which shows that if you have a well-organised population-based screening programme for cervical cancer, it really pays off in terms of deaths. Now, we have another one here that people have screened for, but there's no screening programme. And so what we have here is prostate cancer. And here we see Northern Ireland had probably about 300 cases of prostate cancer per year in 1993, and now it's about 800, nearly 900, and that's because of the increased detection of cases with PSA screening. Mortality hasn't changed at all. We're just picking up early cases. We're still picking up the same number of advanced disease, people with bone metastasis, exactly the same number, and yet all these men will have had treatment, and some of the treatment may have led to serious side effects. Just as an aside, the Cancer Registry received a grant from the Prostate Cancer Charity to study this, and we could be contacting some of the GPs in the audience to help us out with information about patients. But I think it's a very important area to study, because the long-term effects of this on men's health and well-being needs to be documented. Because more and more men are having to make decisions about treatment, and the information just really isn't out there. So enough about prostate cancer, we could have a whole evening on that. Now just back to see, what's the burden of cancer in Northern Ireland, and if we were to talk about early diagnosis, where would we want to work to make the best impact? So if we look at, this is men, so the most common cancer in men and women is non-melanoma skin cancer, but lung is a big one in men. There's prostate there, colon, rectum, stomach. But the deaths are lung, colorectal, esophagus and stomach. So, and the pattern is quite similar for females, except we have breast cancer in here as the big one. These are the cases of breast cancer, but the proportion who die is much smaller. And we also have lung cancer and colon and ovary and rectum. So we need to be thinking, you know, if we were to have an early diagnosis initiative, we would want to do it in something that where it would make a difference. This is, if we look at lung cancer, this is shows how poor the outlook is for lung cancer. But it has actually improved, so we were looking to see what's the trend in survival. So this is 5-year relative survival. Women are slightly better than men in terms of a lot of cancer survival, and lung cancer is one of them. But here we see for males diagnosed 93 to 96, compared with 97 to 2000, there is an improvement. Very small, but that's lifting up. And if we look at the people who had surgery, there's been a marked improvement for them because they're picking the patients better and they're having better post-op care and better surgery and all that. So there is something to be done for lung cancer patients that will actually improve their survival. If we look though at lung cancer and early diagnosis, we have done some work in the cancer registry, and looking at 2006 diagnosed patients, there were almost 900 of those. Half of them presented as emergencies. So they weren't diagnosed until they presented at A&E in some emergency condition. And almost half of them were late stage 4, and 90% of those, more than 90% of them, had died after 1 year. 85% of the patients went directly into palliative care. And, however, 12% of these patients had curative surgery, and their 1 year survival was 83%. So if we can get these patients and get them in early, there is something that can be done for them. But we also asked patients about their delay, and this is what the patients did. So they had, of these 900 patients, 10% of them had a cough, and 20% of that 10% had that cough for over 6 months. Weight loss, 10% of patients had weight loss, and a quarter of them had that symptom for over 6 months before they were diagnosed. Breathlessness, 8% had this symptom, and 17% had it for over 6 months. And pain, 5% of patients had pain, and 1% of those people, so 10 people had pain that they put up with for more than 6 months. If we look at hemoptysis, which is a very visible sign, these are the changes over time. We monitored this over time. And we saw that in 1996, 19 patients had hemoptysis for over 6 months. But by 2006, this had gone down to 2 patients. So I think there's an increased, we are getting people that bit earlier, and I would suggest that that's evidence for it. If we look now at observed survival for breast cancer, sorry for these lines coming in, this is observed survival. So remember, we were working on relative survival. Well, the observed includes deaths from other causes. So these are the 100 patients in the room. How many of them are left after a certain time period? So this is months since diagnosis. So we go up to 2 years here. But what we can see for breast cancer is a very marked improvement in survival over 10 years. And these are Northern Ireland patients. So you should all sit back and give yourself a bit of a pat on the back for that. And it is continuously improving as well. So the next time that we are with Eurocare, we might be moving up that, or down. We'd be better going down because the survival is better at the bottom. Of course, breast cancer depends on the stage, and it's much better for stage 1 than for the later stage disease. And that's why there's the breast screening, and why we need to have people come in earlier. But what symptoms do women with breast cancer have? And what delays are with the patient? Okay. So This is how many of them had a lump. So if we look for 12 plus months, okay, 5% of the women had, and this is 2006, 5% of the women had a lump for over 12 months. So there's a bit of work needs to be done there. How many of them had pain? 4% had pain for over 12 months. So, you know, if you look at over 6 months, 10% of women had a lump over 6 months. 7% had pain for over 6 months. And these are of the people who had this symptom. It's not of all the women, because not all of them. They would all have different symptoms. And nipple discharge or abnormality, 10% had that for over a year, and 20% had it for over 6 months. If we look at esophageal cancer, again we see survival had, this is all patients, 1996, 2001 and 2005, and there is an improvement here in the top line there is 2005, but not very much. So if we look at by stage of disease, we see that the earlier stage disease has better survival. So for all of these cancers, the earlier it's diagnosed, the better it is. And what about patient delays for this? Well, if we look at difficulty swallowing, we see that 3%, there were 158 patients had this symptom, and 3% had it for over a year, 8% had it for over 6 months. Weight loss, 18% had that symptom for over 6 months. Chest pain, 7% had it for over 6 months, and loss of appetite as well. So people are sitting at home with symptoms. There has been some reduction in this over time if we look at 96 compared to 2006, so people are coming that wee bit earlier. So if we think back to our overall delay, so we've looked at this bit here, and now we want to look at some of the system delays that we were able to pick up. So it can't all be blamed on the patient. Now, those of you who are working in GP and all will know that there are targets for waiting times in Northern Ireland since 2008. And there's a 62-day target from your referrer to you start treatment. And there's a 31-day from decision to treat to treatment. And the GPs have a red flag facility, so they can send in and say, I think this patient has cancer. Now, a lot of the patients that they send in, some of them do have cancer, but a lot of them don't have cancer. How do we know what's going on? Well, some of you might be familiar with this new patient system. It's a new system that's used in the hospitals, and it's one that actually the Cancer Registry developed the prototype of it, and it's about monitoring cancer targets. So up here we have these numbers, and this is a countdown in terms of the waiting time. So at the multidisciplinary team meeting, when the surgeon's there and the pathologist and the radiologist and everybody's there, all this is projected onto the wall, and they're discussing the patient, and various bits are entered. And meanwhile, everybody's keeping an eye on these times. And it's monitored. See, that's the bit that they keep an eye on. Now, the other thing is that this also gets rid, this system gets rid of the secretary having to dictate the letter, so that's a time delay. And so what happens is that the letter goes off. Will I show you that again? Am I able to see the letter going off to the GP? So the letter goes off and it's signed at the meeting. So there's no need for somebody to sit and think, oh, I have to go do my letters after my clinic, and I have to, you know, the way it used to be, 2 weeks later you'd be getting through your letters, and the GP might eventually get it or whatever. This way it should be done, and it should actually become automated, so it'll go by email. So the GP nearly know as soon as before the patient's home, what's been happening. So these are all about improving the timeliness and the early diagnosis. And this is the tracking, and it just shows, you know, in any trust, what's going on. So they have so many people who have cancer, there's so many with no cancer, there's so many with suspect cancer that they're monitoring. And there's somebody actually sitting there and monitoring all this, so that if a patient will get their PET scan, they'll get their MRI scan, they'll get their chest x-ray, they'll get whatever before the time runs out. So it's all been speeded up within the hospital, and it's individually directed care. And so there's all this monitoring, you know, how many were under target, how many were over target, and the trusts are really hauled over the coals if a patient was over target. So there's big moves there to improve, and
you know all about that because you haul them in.
Now the red flags, there's, you know, time, we can look at cancer waiting times and how well people wait. So these are red flag patients and these are other patients. So it looks like for most of the cancers that irrespective of whether you're red flagged or not, you're seen in the system quite well. There's a bit of delay for other patients who have colorectal cancer because of all this red flagging. And there's a big delay for the prostate cancer patients because there's a lot of non-cancers in the red flag system who are clogging up the system. And so the challenge is to see how we can better red flag patients, how we can better differentiate if somebody's really likely to have cancer as opposed to if they don't have cancer. So there's quite a bit of work going on in that. Now, with this here, I want to just show you some of these graphs, and I've explained this one to you. This is what's happening in the system. So this is for all the patients who are diagnosed with different cancers. So this is colorectal cancer. So what we see here is we aim to have, you know, 100% of patients diagnosed within either a month or 2 months or 3 months of referral. So we can see that for most of these here, in all the 3 years, almost all of them were seen, first seen in hospital. So, you know, very few of them had to wait more than 3 months, and the majority of them were seen within a month. Okay? The majority of them, in fact, were seen within a week. And here we have the 2006, 2001, and 1996. And what we see here is actually it's falling a bit. We're not doing as well, we're doing slightly less. So what's happening with some of the other conditions? That's colorectal. Now, if we look then at more recent times, so that was from our reports, and here we see 2008, 2009, actually 2008 was a brilliant year because we pulled it all up again, and that was the waiting time. But now the system's clogging up a bit again, you know, so that's maybe the red flags are doing that. We just need to keep an eye on that. So I'll show you similar ones for, and this is referral to first treatment. So here we see again, we weren't, we were getting worse. But then we did do a little better once the cancer waiting times were introduced. This is for lung cancer, and you can see if 50% of patients come in through A&E, well then, you know, they're going to be diagnosed very rapidly. And we can see that, you know, there were very few patients who had to wait more than a month from referral to they were first seen at hospital. So the lung cancer patients were being seen very quickly. And this then was referral to first treatment, and you can see, you know, that was slower, but we can see that it has improved, and this is the more recent time here. So it was going down a bit, and then the cancer waiting times were introduced, and everybody's focused on that now. So a bit of targeting doesn't do any harm. Here we see breast cancer, and again we see the very same pattern where it was getting a bit slow, and then it speeded up again, and then. The same for referral to first treatment. Prostate, the very same pattern. So we're able to monitor these things for Northern Ireland and see how well everything's doing. And that's prostate again. So one of the other things that we have been looking at is if we think of early diagnosis, if you look at deaths within 3 months of diagnosis, well, those are really very late diagnosed cases, and this is Northern Ireland data, where we see that 42% of male lung cancer patients, 38% of females, die within 3 months of diagnosis, and I'm sure that's your clinical experience. Breast cancer, only 3% died within 3 months of diagnosis. Colorectal, a bit more, but for colorectal, about a third of cancer of them present as an emergency. Ovary, 20%. die within 3 months of diagnosis. So that means there's a huge pool of late diagnosis out there that we need to target. These ones are more likely if the people are deprived or if they're older. And 5% of all our cancer patients die during their last admission to hospital. So they're only they're diagnosed and they die. So these people come into hospital not knowing what's wrong with them. They're diagnosed with lung cancer, and before they get home, they die. So 1 in 20, which is a big thing for us to target. So I want to just finish off really by telling you about a major project that we're involved with, which is called an International Cancer Benchmarking Project, which was established in 2009. So we've seen that there's international variation in cancer survival. We've seen that it's quite marked in these cancers here, colorectal, lung, ovary and breast. We're not doing as well as we could. We have joined up with 12 participating jurisdictions. There's in the UK, there's England, Wales and ourselves. In Canada, there are 4 of the states and provinces of Canada, isn't it? And the states of Australia. Sweden, Denmark and Norway. And so there's a major initiative going on, and we hope that in the Lancet before Christmas there will be the first of papers coming out from this, which show how the survival in these countries compare with one another. And just to tell you, we're with very similar to the UK, but we're slightly better. And since the UK are driving this, we mightn't see that, you know, we might gloss over that, but we're slightly better. But we're still not nearly as good as Sweden or Denmark or Norway. So there's various stages of this project. So the first module is the one where we've given all our data and it's been analysed. And it looks at survival rates, and that's the one that's almost finished. The next stage has been funded by the Public Health Agency, and there's going to be a survey of population beliefs and awareness about cancer. So we'll get maybe to the bottom of this, and then there may be initiatives to raise awareness about these cancers. But it's about cancers in general, meant more than these ones here. So that should be very informative. And it'll also tell us how we compare with these other countries. Module 3, then, is differences in primary care. So if a GP gets a certain set of symptoms, what is he likely or she likely to think this could be cancer or this maybe isn't cancer? Do the GPs have access to direct radiology? Can they refer in, or do they have to go through something else? And there's differences in different countries. Do the patients have to pay? You know, there are all those things which could affect that. So that will be measured here in this module 3. And we're linking with Nigel Hart in the academic department of general practice, who's working on this. Module 4 is then, what bits do the patients think delayed them? So the thing is, what we're going to do is we're going to ask patients themselves, you know, how long did you have your symptoms? Why, you know, maybe why did you not think it was cancer then? You know, had you long time to wait for your GP appointment then, you know, to look through their pathway and do a survey of that, backed up with a look at hospital. And then module 5 is, what's the, you know, we know that certain treatments work, but maybe they're not being applied the same in all the different countries. So that's a high resolution study. So we hope to work our way through this over the next 2 or 3 years and have very good answers to some of the questions about why our survival is not so good and what we can do about it. So these are some of the comparisons for these here, and this is from the data that we've done already. So here you can see we are much lower than Canada, right? We're slightly better here, and slightly better there. Although we're nothing to be proud of, because we're bumping really along the bottom here, and so there's a major initiative to be worked out on that. So, if we start to diagnose cancers early, will we save a lot of money? And this is just something we worked out on lung cancer. The hospital costs for 70% of the patients, because we didn't have data on them all, and this is just the hospital cost. not the GP cost, not the anything else, was calculated as £4 million for 1 year, with an average cost per patient of £6,000, and the main cost was the inpatient stay. But it varied by stage, so earlier diagnosis actually cost more, because you do more with them, you just, you know, there's more that you can do. And more patients then would survive for longer, and they'd have increased needs, they may have side effects from therapy. So to diagnose people early, there's a bit of a balance here, because you may not, it may not be cheaper for the health service per se.
So that's something that...
Now, what's happening with cancer in Northern Ireland? These are numbers of cases, right? And when I started with the registry, I would have said, of the serious cancers, there's 6,500 of them. I have to now say there's 8,500 of the serious cancers. If we count non-melanoma skin cancer, every year there's 10,500 cases. And this shows the increase now, that we should have squiggled here, but with the ageing population, that's what's driving that, because our rates are pretty steady, and in fact the rates for some cancers are actually coming down. That's the pressure of an ageing population. But it's also the pressure of, you know, increased investigation of some of these older people and actually recognising that they're in there because of cancer, so they get counted.
So early diagnosis is something that we need to be thinking about for these patients.
So, just to say, there are patient delays and there are system delays that we have. Screening has a role in detecting cancers earlier. There is this international study of cancer of delays ongoing, and we hope to see some results of that. And action on these fronts will reduce the cancer burden, but not necessarily the costs. Thank you very much.
Can I say thank you very much indeed, Anna,
for a very interesting talk. I think you've opened a treasure trove for us. Questions for Anna? I know some people have asked on the way through, but I'm sure she's happy to take some more.
It seems to me, Simon, I don't know about the process that's involved and how you run your registry.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, in terms of how these people are identified, what information you collect, comorbid condition, and obviously you have to have them whenever you're doing your variance adjustments and things. So in terms of how these people are identified and how they get recruited or involved in the registry, could you tell me something?
Okay. Well, the registry aims to collect information on everybody who has cancer, so it's a population-based one. You might hear of studies that are hospital-based or that are just on the patients who had surgery, and those will not count people who you know, live a day after they are diagnosed or whatever. So we aim to collect information on everybody, and the way we do that is we get all the pathology reports and all the diagnosis that say a cancer diagnosis. And in fact, the registry also collects pre-malignant conditions as well, so that has been the basis of some of our research. We then get information from the hospital discharges, so from the PAS system. We also get information from deaths, and now increasingly we're going to get information directly from this computer system that I showed you, the CAP system. We can also get some from radiology and minor sources like that. So what happens is all those are put into the system, and patients are matched. So for some of the patients, everything fits. They have a pathology, they have a hospital discharge that says the same thing, and they may then have a death certificate. So that's all great, and that's a registration. But sometimes all we get is a hospital discharge. And so for those patients, we will go out and check the hospital records, because some of those are patients who maybe were diagnosed before the registry was set up. Some of them may have been diagnosed, they were maybe on holidays when they came over here and they were admitted acutely and they had a diagnosis, and they don't belong to our population. And some of them may not have cancer. There's a query cancer put on the thing and it gets coded and that's it. So we clean that and bring that back and check the data. For deaths, we have a similar process in that all the GP records for people who have died go down to what used to be CSA. And we pay to get those retrieved and check that to see. So if we only have a death record, we will check through the hospital records, if need be, electronically. And then, so we try to get every case that we have in the population. Now, for some of the other things that I showed you, you know the way I was able to show you for 1996, 2001, and 2006? For those years, we were funded by the audit groups, and we went out and looked at every note that we could find on those patients. So occasionally you don't find one, so it's not everybody. But we went and looked at all the breast cancer patients, all the lung cancer patients, all the prostate cancer patients, all the esophageal, all the stomach, all of those patients, melanoma, in 96, in 2001, and then in 2006. And from that, we were able to say what their symptoms were, how long they had the symptoms. We were able to measure their comorbidity. We were able to look very closely at the stage of their disease. And so a lot of the work that I've showed you tonight is from those studies. We spend a lot of time cleaning the data in the registry. So if you were to ask what's the most up-to-date information that we have now, we could give you a really good list of the patients who were diagnosed in 2008. A pretty good list for 2009, but not complete. And some of the quite a few of the patients were diagnosed in 2010. So there's about an 18-month delay in terms of cleaning the data. But we intend now, using some of these newer systems, to have just a 6-month delay. So we're going to work very hard on that. Our staging runs at about 50%, and we aim to put a big effort into improving staging, because if you think about it, over time, if we improve survival, we need to know what's been the factor in that. And the other thing that we're trying to work very hard to do is to get information on comorbidity. And we think actually primary care is the main source of that data. So for the cancer patients, we would ideally like to link into some of the automated systems in primary care for just those patients, so that we would know if they had heart disease, we would know if they had diabetes, we would know if they had a serious condition that could impact on their survival or their care. And that would really leave us ahead of a lot of places in terms of explaining our outcomes and survival.
And the reason that I ask is I'm a neurologist, and I mean, brain tumours figure very highly in that. Mm-hmm. But will you still be picking those up? Because most of the patients I see with brain tumours, they never even see a neurosurgeon. Mm-hmm. Most never have a biopsy taken or any pathology, just because of the nature of the condition and the damage you can do when trying to treat some. But will you be picking those cases up? Mm-hmm.
We pick up all malignant and benign brain tumours.
So meningioma.
Yes, all of those. Yeah, we would have all of those. Mm-hmm. We would have all of those. And if you want, actually, say you wanted to see the list of patients that you had under your flag or under your department or whatever, or of your colleagues with their agreement, the registry would be able to give you that. You know? So you could say, look at their survival, you could do things like that. And the same thing goes for any GP. If say you wanted, and we did write out to the GPs when the new contract came in, and we offered, if you want the list of your patients, you know, to allow you to have a disease register for your payment, and almost all of them, I think everybody said yes please, and so we sent them out the list, and it was a good check for us. So we asked them to check if they were complete, and we got a few minor changes, which was that this patient had died or whatever, which we wouldn't yet have heard about. So it was a very reassuring thing from the point of view of accuracy of the registry, but also giving something back to the people who owned the data.
Philip,
I think
I'll stand up first. Thanks very much, Anna, for what you said. The primary care area is quite a challenging area. It's very noisy, if mm-hmm. I could use that word, mm-hmm. What goes on. Though it's equally important to distinguish or discriminate and get the right diagnosis, or at least the right person. You talked about the red flags. How can we improve that area? I think you mentioned something about that, but I didn't hear it. I can hear you properly, but how are we improving that?
Well, there's a whole lot of research actually going on mm-hmm. in that about how you can better, using various symptoms, identify a cancer. Mm-hmm. And the Northern Ireland Cancer Network has been working with the clinical groups. So, for example, all the urologists get together, or all the colorectal surgeons get together, or maybe all the brain surgeons get together, and also the clinicians as well. And they will look at NICE guidance and various other things, and they will come up with a list of symptoms. So there's an age criteria, there's a criteria, say, of rectal bleeding or whatever for a certain amount of time, plus maybe something else. So those are the criteria that the that NICAN have agreed for those symptoms. But the thing is, they'll miss some cancers and they will over pick other ones. So it's about refining the sensitivity of that. We had a very good study application that we put in, but we weren't successful in getting it funded. So maybe we'll put it in somewhere else, because we're one of the few places that can actually carefully monitor the red flags with this system, because we know whether they're red flagged, we know what their outcome is, you know. And
because it is very challenging. I mean, you're indicating there that it can gum up the system,
mm-hmm.
and many GPs, I'm sure, have patients with lots of symptoms.
Mm-hmm.
So that it is really quite a challenging area,
mm-hmm.
But obviously you're on the case.
Well, we would like to be on the case, but and we have the data there, and we could do it. But you know, you need to have a resource to do that. You know, you need to have somebody to do it. So we have access to all the needed the things, and we just need somebody to do it. You know.
I'm interested that the evidence suggests that if you treat people earlier, that it makes a difference, because
mm-hmm.
if you think about, let's say, two cancers, one
mm-hmm.
where the doubling time is about four times greater than
mm-hmm.
another,
mm-hmm.
The one with the slower doubling time may not do you any harm at all.
Mm-hmm.
The other one, the more aggressive one, is the one that's going to do you harm,
mm-hmm.
but you might not be able to pick that up.
Mm-hmm. That's a real issue,
yeah.
in breast cancer,
yeah.
and in prostate cancer. And that's one of the areas that when you look at a screening program, you have to be able to see, are you actually bringing, you know, are you actually picking up these indolent cases, so your survival improves because you're picking up these cases that are very slowly growing, you know, or are you just picking cases up, you know, a bit earlier, so that the people live longer with the knowledge of their disease, but it hasn't improved survival. So that's a very important point, and that's where you need to be very careful in looking at survival on its own, and that's where it's very important to look at deaths, because deaths are really what you're trying to reduce.
I was thinking of the new kid on the block from a cancer point of view. We've buried two patients in the last 14 months with mesothelioma,
mm-hmm.
and one was a man of 72, a builder, and the other was a man of 54, an electrician,
mm-hmm.
since the age of 16. And it really sets you back on your heels when you certainly see the younger man dying,
mm-hmm.
really no treatment, and it was just a hopeless, you know.
Yeah. Well, I mean, we didn't talk about prevention here at all, but prevention is a major issue, and I think increasingly the deaths from mesothelioma almost match cases. You know, there's a bit of a lag, but not much, and. It used to be the ship workers, and there were a lot of cases around Belfast, and then they actually moved to live outside Belfast, so there was a donut effect, so you could see them outside Belfast. But increasingly, it's now in the construction workers who would have been maybe dismantling asbestos, or who would have been working in houses with asbestos and just working away like that electrician or whatever. And the other group that have it are mechanics, because of the asbestos brake linings and things like that. So, you know, mesothelioma is a serious disease that, you know, but prevention really needs to have a thought given to it as well. And I mean, we're talking about lung cancer there, and you could get rid of 90% of them if we could tackle smoking.
Professor
Haddon? We've all watched what you've achieved for the cancer screening, cancer registry over the past 15 or 20 years since you started, and it's been wonderful what you've been able to do, and to produce data like this and to be able to compare it with other countries is of course crucial.
Mm-hmm.
What I'm really asking is to sort of look a little broader and say, do you think that, is it right that cancer should be the only diagnosis that is given this sort of top line treatment of having a really good register,
mm-hmm.
or would you feel if you had access to the funds that it could be done effectively for other diseases. Mm-hmm. I'm obviously interested in diabetes, but mm-hmm. say epilepsy or heart disease
yes.
or
mm-hmm.
stroke, or
yes.
Would it be possible to get this sort of data that you got?
The way cancer is slightly easier, and I wouldn't say it's easy at all, is because it's been done internationally already, and there's a gold standard there that you have a pathology diagnosis and you can see what it is. In Northern Ireland, there are some diabetes registers. There are cerebral. No, there are exactly. There are cerebral palsy registers. There was the Monica project, which did very good work on heart disease. But I agree that if you want to know about these diseases and about understanding them for your population and monitoring the implications of them and prevention and improving treatment. It's very important to have the information on a population level, because if you have it on a particular proportion of the population, you know, let's say the patients that come to you, you know, it could be a centre, you could be in the centre of excellence, you record them all, but that's like a tip of the iceberg in terms of the total scope of the patient. So it is very important, and particularly if you think of diabetes and the way obesity is going to change things and that, you know. Now GPs do have lists, and that's a very important source of that information. I know, Miriam, you might have some thoughts on that.
Yeah, I mean, just there are lots of morbidity lists, certainly in general practice. How complete they are, I'm not sure. People here are much more informed to comment on that. But I think the point that you make about cancer does have a definitive point at which it is diagnosed, a day that's diagnosed, supported by pathology that helps to stage and is much more definitive than some other things like heart failure, for example, that just be more difficult to quantify with the same kind of accuracy. That's not to say we shouldn't be aiming to do it, because I think there is a wealth of information.
Mm-hmm. And I think just on that point, there's so much data collected in the health service that isn't used in this way, and we really need to have some sort of a legislative framework that allows that data to be used in a way that improves the whole care of patients and yet maintains the confidentiality of that data and you know, allows us to monitor the expenditure on the health service and where it's going and make a case for new resources if they're needed and be able to identify if there's waste in the system.
John Henry Biggert had a little quotation which he always said, the study of things caused must precede the study of the causes of things.
Absolutely.
I want to congratulate you on putting a talk like that together so well at short notice. One question, cancer of the pancreas, the incidences seem to be very low considering how much we hear about it. It doesn't seem to me that early diagnosis offers much for the pancreas.
Yeah, pancreatic cancer, just from the top of my head, I think about 200 cases a year actually, you know, and it does tend to occur more in older people, but there are some young cases, and I mean, I know of somebody who had it and died before they were 30, you know, before they were even 25, I think. So it's very, very poor prognosis. But there is a study going on about lifestyle factors that could possibly influence pancreatic cancer, and also looking for possible blood markers or, you know, history of something that could maybe identify people who are more at risk that we could do something about. It's been a neglected area, and it's one where there is a European-wide study of that, and Northern Ireland's actually contributing some patients. I don't think it's increasing. Some of the risk factors are tobacco and alcohol and chronic pancreatitis.
It
might be that we're hearing more about it. I don't know. I'd have to go back and look to see. But it's not one of the ones that we would have picked up an increase on. I mean, there are increases that we know in terms of melanoma that we can see, renal cancers, uterine cancers, but pancreas is sitting there just not doing very much.
Okay. One more question, I think, before the cake gets cold outside.
I really enjoyed your talk. Could I come back to Philip's point about the red flag system, and
mm-hmm.
I'm not sure whether you made the comment about red flags clogging up the system. That doesn't really surprise me, because
mm-hmm.
the actual positive predictive value of symptoms
mm-hmm.
is very low. And I remember reading an article about a year ago in the British Journal of General Practice, can't remember who the authors were, but there were only about four symptoms
that had a positive predictive value of greater than 5%, and I think they were bidding, year-round bidding in a woman over 50, iron fistula anemia in a man over 50, dysphagia and hemoptysis. Mm-hmm. And I know that there are a very small percentage of cancers that have been red flagged. Mm-hmm. Do you think the red flag system is a good system?
Without evidence, I couldn't possibly comment. Possibly for some patients it works very well, and it gives a bit of power to the GPs to sort of pick up things. Now, I know the trust will reassign some of the patients depending on the criteria, it probably has its good and its bad points, but it does, as you say, it needs to be refined, because one of the risks is that with all these people who are red flagged, first of all, they're very concerned that they're maybe going to be, that they have a cancer diagnosis, it must be serious, they're putting in. But then the patients who have the cancer are then put back in the queue, say for a PET scan or an MRI or a CT scan, because there's other patients ahead of them and they're being monitored on the target. The only thing I would say is that once a patient then is diagnosed, irrespective of what way they've come in, they're then on this target for timeliness. So I think the targets for timeliness have actually improved the service for patients. It's at a huge price in terms of the energy that the trusts have put into it. But I think that, it would be a shame to lose that and undo that from what we can see here.
Catherine, thank you very much, Anna.